Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water industry. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs, and Aquarius Spectrum, providing advanced fixed-base leak detection solutions to the water utility business. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 15 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today, my guest is Eric Schwartz, co-founder of Blue Conduit, developing an accurate lead service line inventory and replacement plan to protect public health, maintain community trust, and manage public funds. Hey, Eric, thanks for being a water entrepreneur and appearing on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So again, you're not at WEFTEC today, so you know, you're not hanging out in New Orleans and doing all the things that everybody gets to do in New Orleans.
Yeah, I've got three of my team members are there, so we've got folks from product, from operations, and our commercial sales team. So excited about all the updates I've been hearing every day from them.
Yeah, those big conferences are very interesting, you know, especially now since everybody's back in the saddle and everybody's there. It's always a great opportunity to see all the people you just talked to on the phone and by Zoom.
And see how tall they are.
Or short, you know, whatever the case may
that's
be.
Right.
I recall being in university in the early 1970s and becoming aware of the link between philosophy, symbolic and Aristotelian logic, and computer programming. I was really surprised to realize the close connection between these two disparate areas of my interest. I see by your CV that you're a professor of marketing and have done research on retail product pricing models and native advertising. You're currently at the University of Michigan, where you're naturally positioned to apply these same statistical and data mining methods to the Flint water crisis. Can you talk a little bit about how the mathematical concepts you work with can apply to these seeming disparate areas of interest?
I love that, Paul, because my background also involved seeing linkages between seemingly distinct, disparate areas of academia, of the world, of research. And I knew I was just interested and attracted to quantitative methods. And very early on as an undergraduate at University of Pennsylvania, learned this idea of a mathematical model to do things. Initially, it was just predicting customer behavior. And so I went into marketing. But I also realized that there was a real opportunity to recognize that often the distinctions between domains are really superficial, and the underlying patterns are the same once you look at the data. So we could be talking about customer churn and unsubscriptions, you know, unsubscribes to Netflix as is a big issue in the news in the Wall Street Journal today, but we'd be using the exact same method to predict a high school dropout and churn across universities and churn across all sorts of other contexts, or employee churn, or survival after cancer, and the list goes on. And that really opened my mind to the ways that I could apply these same methods that I was learning and would learn it to something good for the world that would help folks. And I just kind of had that approach to doing a PhD, to becoming a faculty member. And I can't say I was really active for most of that time in achieving those ends until 2016, when just having that mindset and having conversations with people in Flint, Michigan, during the kind of peak moment of the international news media, had already left in late mid 2016, and just realizing how big of a challenge of just uncertainty and lack of information. And I said, well, I know methods that deal with uncertainty and decision-making, and when you need to decide how to allocate resources over time, when you're uncertain about where to go, I'm familiar with those kind of methods. And that's really how these areas came together. Data science for social good, that wasn't all that much of a thing as a buzzword, but now it very much is.
So based on the Flint issue, I want to ask you about how you got in to focus on lead service lines, but how did you get, was it just kind of the media attention that brought you to the topic? Did you have connections in either the public health arena or the water utility arena? You know, what was your entree into kind of learning about this different area of focus?
Sure. I'll give, there's two combined forces. The first also goes back to my undergraduate training in working with community partners and community organizations in problem solving really nasty, challenging problems, like high school retention and economic development in West Philadelphia. The second was very much more practical in Google.org approached my colleague, Jake Abernathy, through the University of Michigan and the Flint campus and the Ann Arbor campus, and said, hey, we want to do something for Flint. We want to build an app of sorts, and we want to do it by giving a gift to the University of Michigan, Flint campus, and we want help from Ann Arbor campus, computer science, and you have this data science team, the Michigan data science team, which was just created in 2015 by my colleague Jake Abernathy and students. I then was an advisor to that team as well, and it just allowed us to open some doors, and it just gave us the excuse to take a bus full of 30 kids to Flint, about an hour north of Ann Arbor, and schedule some meetings with public officials and people from the Greater Flint Community Foundation and people who worked in City Hall, people who were working in the water utility, to just kind of tell us what's going on. And it was on that trip, on that set of meetings, where we just asked some basic questions like, well, how many people in Flint have lead contamination? And they said, well, we don't really know. We're like, well, okay, well, the lead pipes, the lead service lines, we understand are the main source of the lead contamination here, because we understood, we just learned about the water chemistry and how the lead was leaching off because of the particular mixture of the treatment of the water and the materials of the pipes. So how many lead pipes are there? We just don't know. We don't know. And then we just kept digging, and it became kind of a forensic data science exercise. So we said, well, what, surely you have some information. And I said, sure. They sent a spreadsheet of information. And those initial records were based on water logged old atlases books from, the basement, literally the basement of City Hall, that now we've seen in dozens of communities are showing off these books nowadays that are handwritten. And most of them are just outdated or wrong, or they were most updated in Flint's case in 1984. And they don't have the service line materials written down perfectly for every home. They're mostly empty. And so that said, based on that, it was around 10 to 20% of the city was expected to have lead. And of course, then the state said, we have data. We've gone and inspected 3,000 homes. And based on that, 3% of the homes have lead. We're like, well, these are already quite different. So, the uncertainty just kept growing, actually. Well, it turns out, they only looked on the private customer owned side in the house, not the harder to reach public side. And then we said, well, have you done any actual digs lately? Yep, we've done some digs, and 30 out of 33, 33 to 36 have lead. Well, you cherry picked those, right? Well, of course we did. That's what we're trying to replace the lead. And then we honestly, one of the first things we did after they had found 96% lead in the first around 150, 200 digs, said we need to know how much is out there. And so we recommended a list of about 200 or 300 homes that were representative of all of the remaining unknowns. And that yielded about 40% lead after a few hundred homes. There's now been 25,000 digs in Flint in these 6 years, 6.5 years. 40% of those have yielded lead. So just in getting an average, just how much money do I need to apply to my state revolving fund for? How much money should I ask my regulator for? How many lead pipes should I tell the public we have, we expect to have, we expect to replace? All of these numbers, we just need to get a basic estimate. Forget about knowing house by house where they are. And I'll get to that. But that was our entree, really was, sure, we knew that we had to work with communities, we knew we had to work with public officials, but basically asking the hard questions, which we thought would be easy, and turned out to be hard.
So did the students on the bus ride home from Flint kind of brainstorm what they were going to do next?
Yeah, we had we had a hackathon. It was during finals in May 1st, 2016. We all sat together in a room on the North Campus of the University of Michigan in the engineering school, and we had a little hackathon all day. And somebody was, you know, questioning a public tweet by the governor's office that didn't really make sense with the data that we were seeing. Someone else was trying to see what is the correlation between the existing data that we have on pipes and the water testing. Another group was trying to predict, can we predict what the water tests will reveal in terms of parts per billion that we're getting? And then really just one of many questions was, what about this like service line material type? Could we predict what those are if we had more data? And that's really how this whole company started, was just a hackathon of undergraduate and graduate students and professors working together to, you know, play with data with good motivation.
Thank God for universities.
It's a pretty special job, and I don't take it for granted a single day. It's allowed me to do not just the research and teaching and mentorship and serve the university, but also create a company like Blue Conduit with the support of, in my case, the University of Michigan. But I would be, you know, far from the first to say universities, you know, have their faults as well. But in this setting, it's been pretty nice.
So you touched on it a little bit, but I'm curious to understand how you were able to, kind of generate that first model and the algorithms to be able to accurately predict, first of all, where or how many lead service lines there might be, and then where. And then some follow-up questions. I'm really curious to know if, you know, this data analysis tool set is transferable from location to location. You know, I'm thinking about fractal patterns, to be real honest. And, you know, in your case, you're going from smaller to bigger. But once you have kind of a nationwide model, can you then transfer that to, you know, Timbuktu, Oklahoma, with good results?
Yeah. And honestly, that is core to the model of Blue Conduit's business model and Blue Conduit's growth within the service line area. Of course, we have areas beyond just finding lead pipes, but I'll hit on that exactly. Because we now have several examples, and by several, I mean about 70 different cities around the US, we have been able to generalize, as you've said. And we actually now have a model at not the address level, but at the water system level. So for every water system in the country, we have an estimate for the number of expected lead service lines. And we're making that public. That is now on our website. That is a solution we are just putting out there, LSL estimate for any water system. You put in a water system, public water system ID, you'll get out an estimate, and that we internally have a map, and that will be public very soon as well. And the idea is that we want this information out there because this is about public health, but also public information, that we understand that removing lead service lines is supporting healthy living. Also, the average consumer, the average family drinking water ought to know what might be going on in their water system before knowing even what is going on explicitly in my neighbor's house or my house or around the corner. And so that is part of our mission, is to make that information available. And so, yes, we have a model that uses characteristics of water systems, summarizing the kind of aggregate, as you put it, the kind of fractal going up, not down, and then goes back down and can predict what's going on in water systems that we have not yet been to, but we know some information about at a high level. And that also will, that work is being funded not just by google.org now, but also by the Rockefeller Foundation. And that work will help attract attention in communities that really need to do something about it and do need to drill down to the address by address, service line by service line prediction.
The fact that EPA is mandating, lead service line inventories and replacement plans by, was it next 2 years from now, I guess?
2024, October.
Okay, there you go. I'm assuming that helped drive your company's success.
Yeah, I think that announcement came in some ways, it was welcome, but also expected, because we had already started the company in 2019, well before the EPA made that announcement, but while the EPA was intervening in Flint, in Pittsburgh, in Newark, and both the litigation, the advocates, and the policy looked, it was like it was heading in that direction. I think the surprise maybe was how early it came. Most of this rule was written and established in December 2020. Wow. It's just taken a really long time for revisions and now kind of official possible changes by this administration. But the core of it has actually been there for quite some time now. And we were up and running. Before it, the bipartisan infrastructure law, that's a huge win. We had seen proposals in Congress, $21 billion, $45 billion mentioned, but those weren't going very far. And when that really went, that it became not just an unfunded mandate from the EPA, but a funded one. And that's, I think, this combination of two tailwinds that any business would dream of having one of them. But we've got both at the same time, and we were ahead of the game from Blue Conduit's perspective. I think that's been really exciting. And that two-year deadline is really crucial. And what should our customers, the water utilities around the country, what should their two-year plan be? How are we kind of helping to build that two-year plan for decision makers and the public? It really needs to involve right away data management and inventorying and connecting the inventory to replacement plans, connecting the inventory to water testing, connecting the inventory to communication to residents. And it really is just being smarter and keeping it simple, but being smart about this inventory, that you have a lot of unknowns. You have a lot of areas where you just don't have any confirmed materials of your service line, and you need to say something about them. You want to make sure it's right.
So I worked for the city of San Diego for 25 years and American Water for 9 years. And I, in many of the areas that I try to influence, the lack of a complete structured data set always hindered us. I mean, I can remember working on Mylar as-built drawings, back in the day, with pen and ink, and And, you know, it's like, man, this is, but that seems like it's a whole nother world to go.
It's not as far as you might think, because a lot of those same exact documents that you may have been looking at are still the best available information that folks have in some of those water systems. And it is the case that we have been involved in even physically digitizing and worked with partners to digitize some records, as we did in Flint. And that just gets you to scanned images. And then there's some machine processing of those scanned images with some human intervention to make sure that we're getting, you know, as close to, you know, handwriting and optical character recognition. But even once those data sets exist, even once we're dealing with spreadsheets or shape files of maps, even that information has holes in it. And the holes really are the reality that we have not dug a hole at every single home in the past 20 or 30 years since the lead bans really kicked in properly in 86 or 91, depending on how you think of it. And we also know that some of the old records are incomplete. Often people were just writing down what they saw on the utility side, but have no idea what's on the customer side. So a lot of folks are saying, we have a full inventory of full inventory, until the EPA rule just came out and said, no, you don't, actually. You have an incomplete inventory everywhere. And what we do, we like to think of, we just fill in those gaps. So Blue Conduit is we see there's some kind of blue dots here where we know that there's copper and non-lead. There's some red dots over here where we know that there's lead or galvanized. But they're very sparse, and everything in between is just gray. And what we do is we shade it in with shades of blue or red, for instance, of what's the likelihood that any one of these addresses, service lines, is lead or galvanized versus not. And what that translates to is a prioritized list, not just an inventory, but direction of where to go for replacement. So it might say, if you need to cluster by neighborhood, where are we going to go? Well, let's find the neighborhood with the highest concentration of lead lines. Or maybe you can pick out blocks at a time. Well, what are the blocks of our street system or census blocks even that have the highest concentration of lead that we should prioritize? Or how do we overlay equity information here? Now that we know where the lead is, how do we make sure that we're actually going where there's lower income folks, or where we go where we know that there's a higher number of children under six, for instance, or people who are ill? And I think those are the ways that the inventory immediately becomes a plan of action if we do it in a smart way, as opposed to just information for reporting's sake.
Do the utilities give you back the results? You know, yes, you know, we dug up these areas, lead, no lead, this thing, that thing. And then do you use that information to retrain the model?
Great question, and spot on with the language. This is not a one-time project. So not only do they give us the data, but we're the ones who provide the system to collect it and integrate with, whether it's Esri or CityWorks, fully connected through APIs now, to be able to get all of that data and push new data back to them and recommendations. But as that data comes, we are updating, as you put it, as every data point gets in, we can rerun this model. And that model then will be able to do some smart things. For instance, if we start seeing that even though we were predicting lead in a certain area, but we start seeing a frequency of copper, then the model is going to adjust and starts deprioritizing some areas. Or the reverse, if we had a kind of a lower likelihood in some region of lead, but we're now digging in another region where we have homes, say, of a similar style or build or era, and it might be in the 50s, so it may not be really far back. Maybe it's actually surprisingly recent, 50s or 60s, but those same era homes were finding lead there. Then in this other neighborhood, we're going to see kind of a hot spot pop up, possibly of higher likelihood than we initially anticipated. And this is an illustration of, you can't use year of home alone. It is helpful. The year of home, of course, is helpful. There's a lot of reasons why we have to be careful about it. For instance, building patterns are strange. Trends went in many different directions. It could have been popular to use lead in the 40s and unpopular in the 50s and then popular again in the 60s. So it's not linear either. The other issue is the data itself are not really the data about when the service line was installed. It's year built typically, and year built can mean it's the year that the new home was built after the old home was torn down. So you could have sometimes year 1993 and a lead pipe in there. Well, sure, the lead was installed in 62 and the home was knocked down and rebuilt in the 90s. So the data is tricky there. And so you don't want to depend only on that, just like you don't want to depend only on records that were largely written 80 years ago.
I recall one of my positions at the city of San Diego was to deal with leaking underground storage tanks. And just like you said, you know, the null hypothesis was, oh, the older the tank, the more likely it is to leak. Well, we went back, we did the inventory, we started working on the older tanks, and they were great. I mean, the wall thickness was great. They had so much, you know, anti-corrosion stuff on them. What it turned out was, over time, up until about the 70s, the construction material of the tanks got worse and worse and thinner and thinner. And what we found at the end of the day was the tanks put in the 70s, and this was 1986, they were the worst ones. And we're like, who knew? You know, but until we had enough data set to look at things, we were barking up the wrong tree, and we were, you know, not spending our money where we should have been spending it.
It's a great anecdote, and I think really telling that it does, you know, there's a lot of similar patterns that can be discovered in service lines. But at the end of the day, we want to be digging and prioritizing to dig where the lead is and dig where it's going to make the biggest impact on public health. And the fact that we now have the ability to use predictive modeling, that it is an EPA approved and recognized method, that it is allowed, approved, accepted, whatever language you want to use. It's listed right in there, and the EPA is even citing Blue Conduit and my research specifically with my collaborators. And if you look in those papers, those are papers that are co-authored, not just by me and Jake Abernethy, but by former students at the University of Michigan from that hackathon, from that group in 2016, some of whom are now graduates and now are members of our team and members of Blue Conduit. But it is critical to know that there's a lot of talk about like, oh, will this state or that state accept predictive models? The EPA has. The EPA is recommending it. They're not requiring it, but they're recommending it. And certain states now are starting to say the same, that we are recommending it. It's on our list of methods that you should be using. It's just not practical economically, financially, but also it doesn't even make sense from a public health perspective to just say we're digging everywhere. Well, where are you going first? You can't dig everywhere this year. You need to prioritize somewhere.
So is that, from a purely financial perspective, is that the value proposition to prioritize locations to go after first? Is that really the value proposition?
Listen, if you have a fixed budget, you have $10 million to get out all the lead in your city. If you spend all of a sudden you've spent 10,000 digs, you've spent a lot of money, the public money. How much lead have you taken out in those 10,000 digs? Right. Well, how much do you expect to reduce the time that people are living with lead, given that fixed budget? If you are able to replace 8,000 lead pipes out of your first 10,000 digs, good on you. 80% is probably good. Now, 80% hit rate in that sense is really great in a town that has maybe 30, 40% lead. Doesn't really mean much if the town itself had 80 or 90% lead. You could be just shooting fish in a barrel there. You could do anything. And that is the case in some places. It's very rare. More places than not, we're seeing, you know, 20 to 40% lead, where, yeah, it is actually going to be pretty tricky to be efficient with this because you don't want to be digging all these holes. So if you dig 8,000 out of 10,000 versus, you know, 3,000 out of 10,000, in the case of 3,000, that means that 7,000 of these, you're just digging up copper and filling this hole back in, and you've got a whole crew, you've got equipment, you've got permitting, you've got time, people are living with lead. All of those are massive costs, and thousands of dollars each time. And so it's a question of just initially, just reduce that waste. Reduce, we can't eliminate it perfectly. If we had complete inventories, we wouldn't be having these conversations.
Right.
But
they wouldn't need you.
To reduce the effective cost per successful service line replacement is the goal from a financial perspective, because that lines up with the public health goal. That right. lines up with getting the biggest ROI in our in terms of public health from our public dollars.
Did you start Blue Conduit, as a one-man show? Did you start with a kind of fully blown team or partial team? What was the genesis of the company?
Well, we started really initially with my co-founder, Jake Abernethy, and then Jared Webb as our chief data scientist. Jared really was kind of the lead student at the time, graduate student in all that work at Michigan. And then he really just joined us after that time. And it was the three of us, and we pretty much were running the show as kind of a consulting shop. We added a couple of folks in the first year, but it remained pretty small team, 5-6 people. But after about 12 months or 18 months, we saw the writing on the wall with the shifting political tides in 2020, and saw that there was, even in 2020, talk of Infrastructure Week and water funding, and although some of it was, almost a joke, eventually it was going to come, and it did. It has come in the form of the bipartisan infrastructure law. And we knew that it would be inevitably pretty bipartisan, that lead service lines hasn't been really a partisan issue as much as most other things have been. So by 2021, we started really ramping up and starting sort of both business growth, but serving more customers and growing the team. And now we have about 22 people employed at Blue Conduit, and we're really proud to have partnered with our charitable partners like Rockefeller and Google.org and the Kresge Foundation local to Detroit, and been able to do so without needing to go out and gobble up too much funding really at all. We've been pretty closely funded by mostly just angel investors that we know, and the team owns a whole lot of the business, and
nice.
it's been really great to grow in this way.
What are the similarities between the academic world and the business world, and are those skills transferable?
Oh boy, I'm a funny kind of academic, because I have been an academic in a business school now for almost 10 years plus 5 years of graduate school, so I'm very much around the business world, but those who can't teach. So I'm very much never really pegged myself as an entrepreneur. I think the skill sets, Jake and I talk about this often, that there are certain skill sets in entrepreneurship that could make an academic very good at managing their research portfolio and managing risk and managing people and staff and students. And I think there's a lot to be gained in project management and in that way, coming from kind of a world of software product management. I think that from the business side, something that's been really valuable is to really have kind of that academic ethos throughout the company, because of our start, because of the values, because of the founding team and the story. There's just a really strong mission to kind of do the right thing and find out what's right, find out what's true. And there's just deep curiosity, which has enabled us to be open to thinking about extensions of the product. And, you know, I said, you know, we're at the outset that we're interested well beyond just predicting which pipes are lead, that there's a reason we started with the name Blue Conduit doesn't have really water or pipes explicitly, although both are implicit there. And it's because we already are exploring other areas. So we have some work going on with in the state of Michigan with lead paints, which from a blood lead level in children perspective is arguably a bigger concern issue than the lead pipes. But the lead pipes are on mostly public property, made with public water, and the lead paint isn't. And so that's a tough challenge, but equally, if not more, of a public health issue. We've also now started to talk about quite a bit with folks, not just about pathogens like Legionella, but other components of a water infrastructure system like water mains, water meters, and looking at failures and likelihood of failures and revenue loss there. And so we're super excited to continue pursue things in the water industry and even beyond in climate and sustainability, where there's real uncertainty of where the hazards are, where the possible upgrades are, and we have to allocate a limited budget to find those and replace them and remediate them to prevent other issues. So yeah, we think it's a pretty general set of problems where the infrastructure internal to Blue Conduit and software that we're building is really the backbone of many problems, not just the lead pipe.
What advice would you give to someone who's considering starting, you know, a new company in the water business? Do you have any insights into that?
I think it's valuable to have a team that reflects a water and non-water background. And I think that the balance there has been really important for us. A lot of our team is not water background, but over time, our own experience in the lead service line world actually became the experience. There just weren't that many people who had been doing this for even today for more than 5 years, like we had been. But the balance of getting people who have worked in water or infrastructure, GovTech, versus those who have maybe the general product software skills or technical data science skills, or just general sales skills in other areas. We find that the mixture of those perspectives, team dynamics and really great questions that people are asking that we're borrowing from other areas without really much friction. We're generating new ideas at a rate that I think is a testament to a diverse team in that way. So that would be kind of a big takeaway, that if you want to really be innovative, you can't just keep doing the same thing that everyone's used to doing. Everyone's been trained in the same way.
Yeah, that's good insight. Well, I'd say that was a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate the time. It has given me some good insight, because the first time I came across your company, I was like, you know, how good are they really at predicting this stuff? Mm-hmm. And, from my engineering perspective, you know, that's always the first thing I think of. You know, the 20% good, is the 50% good? You know, it's like, okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're doing a really good job at that. And I really appreciate kind of that focus of, you know, public health management and fiscal management. To me, that's those two things. If you can take care of both of those issues at the same time, you're really providing some great benefit. So thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Paul, thank you so much. And really to all your listeners, if you're in the water system world, you know, get started on these inventories for lead service line now. And the sooner you know what you know and know what you don't know, the sooner you're going to be able to, you know what you need. Yeah. And so I'm really excited to be here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera, with additional support from Imagine H2O and Aquarius Spectrum. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you all again next time.